One is to remind you that there will be no class next week. No class next week, the eve of Thanksgiving, we will not meet. Number two, I was made aware of the fact that I look, and some of you look, at the website, the Orzo website, in order to listen to the sessions that you may not have heard. And at first I couldn't find where it was, but then under Jay's guidance I saw that I'd just been scrolled down. And what you have to do when you get to the Talmud class is scroll down. Scroll down because last year's are up at the top, or previous year's are up at the top. But if you want to see this year's classes, they're down below the text. So I remind you all of that because it's a good opportunity to be able to make up for the lessons that you undoubtedly, for one reason or another, were unable to come to. And it's fun to have that option, to be able to listen. Alan, you listened, you said, last week.
Yeah.
And the fidelity was good, you could understand?
It was very good, yeah.
Uh-huh. So the system works. The system is a good one, and you should avail yourselves of it. Now, as I said, we are on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, 37A. What we did last time was we concluded the Mishnah on the English that is on 37A1. We concluded that Mishnah, and that was, you remember the Mishnah about how the Sanhedrin is supposed to be seated. And we learned that the Sanhedrin is supposed to be seated in a semicircle. In a semicircle. And the Mishnah itself immediately told us why that was, the reason for it, and that was so that the members of the Sanhedrin could look at each other. And we discussed the spiritual dimensions of people who look at each other. Now, no sooner did we, go a little bit further, the end part of the Mishnah was about the process of moving up, that if you have a Sanhedrin seated up there, and we're talking first of the Sanhedrin of 23. Remember, there are two Sanhedrin. One is the Sanhedrin of 23, the other is the Sanhedrin of 71. Okay? So we have really two different groups, but they're referred to almost, it's imperceptible sometimes when they're referring to one, when they're referring to the other. In discussing the Sanhedrin of 23, if someone is not able to participate, if a judge, let's say a judge dies, or cannot be there for whatever reason, we learned in the end of the Mishnah that there are three rows of Talmidei Chachamim, of scholars, who are not of the rank of the judges themselves, and they sit in front. And then if a judge on the actual court needs to be replaced, what happens is that since the people who are sitting in front of the court are sitting in order of their hierarchy, there's a hierarchy, in the order of their significance, of their importance, there's their rank, as it were, there's a rank. If one of the judges cannot continue in adjudication, then there's a musical chairs that takes place. Everybody moves one chair over. Okay? And the person who is in the first seat of the front row of the Talmidei Chachamim, he moves into the judge's seat, the last seat of the judges. Okay? And then everybody else moves over one. So that was the Mishnah. So it seemed like the subject is dealt with in a perfectly reasonable, rational fashion. I mean, it all makes sense. It's all something we can understand. And it, in a way, needs no justification beyond what it said about itself. Okay? The fact that the Sanhedrin is sitting in a semicircle, they said, they told us why, so that people could look at each other, all that's fine. So then we got to the Gemara. And the Gemara asks, Mina Hani Mile, from where do we know this? And the first thing that we said last time is, first of all, why do they have to ask that? We already know. Because logic dictated it. There was a certain reasonable logic to this. And instead, they went and they asked, where is the scriptural source for this? Not only did they ask where the scriptural source was, okay, we'll allow them to do that. That is something that the rabbis will frequently do. They may know something either by tradition or by logic, and they will want to find some place in scripture to pin it on. So they find a place in scripture to pin it on, and it's a verse from the Song of Songs, and it reads, your navel is like a moon-shaped basin. Let not the strength of the blend diminish. Now what that means is when the man is hovering over his wife and he is examining close her navel and he begins to drink at the navel. Now this, my friends, is called erotic language. Of all things, here we are talking about the court, and the text that is used is highly sexual text. My goodness. Okay? First of all, we didn't need this to begin with. Secondly, I would have expected there would be some sort of legal text that we would have made reference to. Instead, we have a text of a woman's belly button and what you do on it. Very interesting. Okay? So, we began with that, we proceeded with that, and read it in detail. And then not only that, but the Gemara goes on. Once it's dealing with such a lovely piece of text, and it's making reference to erotic language in the Song of Songs, how could you leave that? Okay, so you stay with it. You stay with it. It's as if they were waiting for this. Finally it came up, and so you don't quit while you're ahead, you just stick with it. You stick with this kind of stuff. So it went on to say, we learned the roundness. Oh, we'll do this very quickly. Yamarkra shararech agan hasar al yasar amazek. Your navel is like a moon-shaped basin, or the New English translation of agan, I mentioned to you last time, is a round goblet. Sahar is round, because the sahar is the moon. So it's a crescent shape. It's a crescent. Modern Hebrew, it means a crescent. In the Talmud, it means the moon. Okay? Sahar means generally the moon. It's a perfect description now of the Sanhedrin, because the Sanhedrin is seated like a crescent. Okay, they're seated like a crescent. But the Aganasar is in the new JPS, is translated as a round goblet. And that's very beautiful, because if you're going to drink from it, you drink from a round goblet rather than a basin. It makes it more elegant. It's a more elegant image, I think. It still maintains its erotic flavor, but it also has an additional level of elegance to it. Okay? Hasar al-Yasar al-Mazik. Shararech, when it talks about the navel, you think it's talking about a navel? Zo Sanhedrin. Okay? It's really talking about the Sanhedrin. Okay. Shehi Yoshevet, Nikra Shema Shararech, it is called Shararech, the navel, Shehi Yoshevet B'tiburo Shel Olam, because it sits at the navel of the world. Here we last time went into a discussion of the notion of the navel of the world, which is the Bet HaMikdash, the temple. The temple is called Tiburo Shel Olam. There is in the phenomenology of the Talmud and in the Midrash, the rabbinic phenomenology, the sense that all spiritual energy is ultimately concentrated in one physical space, and that space is the space of the temple in Yerushalayim. Har HaBayit, therefore, is not any mountain. Har HaBayit is a place where it is HaMakom, as it says in the Akedah, Vayar et HaMakom Merachok. He saw the place from far, says about Avraham Avinu. So why is it called HaMakom? Because that is the Temple Mount. That is the Temple Mount. Why? Because that is Tiburo Shel Olam. That is the navel of the world. Okay, that is the center. The world comes out and is nourished, as is the fact of the umbilical reality. The world is nourished by what comes out of the temple. That is its spiritual center. Now, the Sanhedrin, of course, sits in the temple. Right? It sits on Har HaBayit. It sits in what's called the Lishkat HaGazit, the section, the room, the office of the hewn stone, and that was its location. So on the one hand, here, as Rashi understands it, it is simply a locational metaphor. I don't think it's only a locational metaphor at all. It's a spiritual metaphor. It's a metaphor that has to do with this, the nature of the phenomenology of the temple space and all that inheres in its energy and its power. And that's the Sanhedrin. So it's not just that it's located there, but it is located in Tiburo Shel Olam, okay, in the navel of the world. Agan, and then it goes on, Agan, why is it called Agan? Well, Agan is very much like the word Agan, which we translated, I translated it as goblet or basin, although those are good Hebrew translations. But it is etymologically next door to magen, haganah, magen, magen. So agan is zeshem magen al haolam kulo, right? That which defends the entire world, and that is the Sanhedrin. Agan shehi megina al kol haolam kulo. Okay, that's the power of the Sanhedrin. Hasahar. The Sahar was the round shape, or the crescent shape. Shehi doma l'sahar. It is like a moon. It is like a moon. Al yechsar amazek. Let not the strength of the blend diminish. Sheim hutzrach echad mehem latzeit. If one of them has to go out, now remember, I just explained to you that the Mishnah says that if one person leaves and has to depart from the Sanhedrin, what do you have to do? You have to fill it up again. So there's a different mixture. There's a slightly different mixture as you bring an additional personality onto the Sanhedrin. Okay? Oh, yes, Aramazek, she'im hutzrach echad mehem latzeit, if one has to leave, im yesh esrim u'shlosha keneged Sanhedrin katanaz yotzei. If there is, now here, apparently, according to the commentators, what is going on here, we're talking about the Sanhedrin of 71. The Sanhedrin of 71. If people, you know, they go for a cup of coffee, you got 71 people there, right? People take a break, or for other needs of nature, and they're not there. Well, what's the minimum number that we can to still call the court in session? The minimal number is 23. 23. Im yesh esrim u'shlosha keneged Sanhedrin ketana yotze. That 23rd person can go out and we can still call the court in session. The imlav eino yotze. But if not, that person cannot go out. Now, that this is, in fact, in the text that we are reading, it's not obvious to me. This is creative philology. Creative philology, where you've got language, you've got words, and they're just going to town with us. Now, again, once they have begun and are having such a good time, you just don't stop. So go on to the next page. Okay. Bitnech aremat chitim. Your belly is like a heap of wheat. Right? That's the sense of the whiteness, probably, or the color of the belly. You tell me. I don't want to get too descriptive in what the metaphor is here. Ma are matchitim as a heap of wheat, hakol ne'anim mimenu. All derive benefit from it. Af Sanhedrin, hakol ne'anim mita'amehem. Everyone derives benefit from their reasoning. Again, of course, that's what it says, obviously. You knew that when you read the Song of Songs. But they're just using this and making comments about the Sanhedrin. And the last part of it is going to become crucial for what we're going to, what the Gemara will develop in the next short sugya. Suga kashoshanim. Right? The verse finishes by saying, Suga Shoshanim. Suga Bashoshanim. Thank you. Suga Bashoshanim. It is hedged Bashoshanim with roses. It is hedged with roses. Sheafilu kesuga shel shoshanim lo yifritzu behem pratzot. Israel will not make breaches even through a border as insubstantial as a hedge of roses. That is the Art Scroll translation of this. I think that's an overly simplistic translation. I'll tell you why. If you just think about the redness of the rose and the flower, it could have said lilies, or it could have said, I don't know, hyacinths.
The translation here is lilies.
Well, Shoshanim can be either roses or lilies. Roses or lilies. If it is, because in Hebrew, you have two words that can mean roses. Two words that can mean, one is Shoshana, and the other is Vered. Vered. Shoshan, Shoshana.
Is Vered more generic? Isn't Vered more generic?
The truth is, both the words are used sometimes to refer to roses in the classical literature. Okay? And we don't really know, but I can tell you that in English, it has always been customary to translate this verse from the Song of Songs as a hedge of roses. As a hedge of roses. Now, a hedge of roses is, as you correctly said, is not a benign hedge. Not a benign hedge, because it has thorns. In addition to its beauty, it has a certain substance to itself. It is not, however, like a wall of cement or of stone, a stone wall. Right? It is certainly much easier to breach a hedge of roses. You know, you just have to put on a good pair of pants. But to breach a wall, you need a little bit of a tank in order to get through that wall. So it is a very different metaphor, the hedge of roses, than the normal idea of the fence. Most fences are there not to be breachable. That's the purpose of the fence. Right? You remember Robert Frost. Good fences make good neighbors because you don't cross over them very easily. They are difficult to breach. That's the nature of the thing. So here, it's not really obvious, I don't think, from the text what they're getting at. The English elaborates on it. The English fills it in. The Hebrew doesn't make it so clear. Shafilu kesuga shel shoshanim. Even like a hedge of roses, lo yifritzu behem pratzot, they will not break through it. They will not break through it. Who is the they? We don't really know. You can see that the English fills in Israel because, in fact, what is going to follow is an explanation of what we just read. Very often the Gemara will say something and it will be a unit unto itself, as this was a unit unto itself. This was a sugya. Now, by the way, sugya, even the Hebrew word sugya, unit, okay? A unit, is etymologically connected to this sugya shel shoshanim. Okay? Something is a unit, is demarked. There's a demarcation to it. Right? It is fenced in. So that is suga. In Hebrew, and very crucial to the whole nature of what they are describing here, crucial on two levels. One is etymological, and the other is midrashic, really, is the Hebrew word siag. Right? Ish siag l'Torah. Okay? Shtika siag l'chokhma. It says in Pirkei Avot. Silence is the fence of wisdom. The fence of wisdom. Much of the law, as developed by the rabbis, is a fence around the Torah. All right? It is siag l'Torah. Siag l'Torah. So siag is like suga, right? The fence around the law is like the hedge, and the fence is what kind of a fence? It is a suga b'shoshanim, suga b'shoshanim, so that it is a breachable fence. It is a breachable fence. That's a strange idea, because one would have thought that if you are creating a fence around the law is the law of God, and you are creating a fence around it, it would be an unbreachable fence. But this fence is a breachable fence. Breachable fence. So let's go on. Yes, please.
Is there any mention of the characteristic of the rose with its smell, of being alluring, of its eye appeal, of being attractive?
Well, let's keep it in mind. The answer is no in terms of it being explicit. But since we're dealing with a metaphor, surely that's implicit in the metaphor. I think you're absolutely right.
That's why it works for the Torah.
Okay.
That's why it works for the law. Because you want to run towards it.
Yes. Well, keep it in mind as we read the explanation that follows. Now, keep it in mind as we read the explanation that follows, because you will see the way in which the Gemara itself is now going to tell us a story which illustrates the nature of whatever the antecedent is here, because we don't know who they're talking about. The English said they're talking about Israel, and in fact that's what the story is going to make very clear very shortly. The Hainu di Amarle, yes?
One quick addition, perhaps irrelevant. The fence is breachable, but it's also permeable, so that...
That's also part of the metaphor. You're absolutely right. Because if you have rose bushes that create a fence, it is somewhat breachable and somewhat permeable. It is also somewhat defensible.
Right.
It's all of those things together. It's all of those things together. Now let's look at the example. Vahainu. Now, occasionally the Gemara, when it uses the term Vahainu or Dehainu, Dehainu is sometimes used in modern Hebrew too. Dehainu means it's a sort of an apposite. You're giving a lecture, and you're about to explain what you've just said. You say Dehainu, okay, and he says Vahainu, and to make this more explicit, Diamar lehahu minelar Rav Kahana. This is like the story of what that heretic said to Rav Kahana. I'm going to hear a story about a heretic and Rav Kahana. Amritu, you say, Nida share liyichude bahade gavra. You say that it is permitted for a Nida to be alone with her husband. I'll explain this in just a moment, but let's just take the language first. Efshar eish b'na'oret. Is it possible that fire will come into contact with kindling, Ve'ena mehavhelet, and it won't all turn into a flame? It won't all turn into a flame. So this is the heretics attacked on Rav Kahana. This is an attack on Judaism, the Judaism that is the rabbinic Judaism, of course. This is rabbinic Judaism. Amar le Rav Kahana says to him, HaTorah he'ida aleinu, but the Torah itself gave testimony, bore witness aleinu, about us, about the Jews, Sugah b'shoshanim, that the Jews are hedged with roses. Shafilu kesugah b'shoshanim, lo yifritzu behem pratzot. Even though the Jewish people is surrounded, is hedged by a fence of roses, which they could break through if they wanted to break through, they are people of temerity, of control, of understanding, and therefore they will not break through. Now, first of all, this is a lovely thing to say about Jews, if we're only true. But you'll see shortly, the Gemara understands, has exactly that, it has a little bit of anxiety with the attack. In response to this, but that's the Gemara that we will read shortly. Okay? At this point, let's explain, first of all, exactly what this means, because the imagery here, again, is quite extraordinary. The attack of the heretic. Let's understand what the attack is. Okay? You say that it is permitted for a nida to be secluded with her husband. Now, what are we talking about? When a woman begins to menstruate, the very first sign of menstruation, as a matter of fact, in the Gemara, in Masachet Nida, one of the discussions in Masachet Nida is the color of the menstrual blood. How you identify it, how do you know when you're looking at something that can be just an issue, something that can be part of, you know, something that comes out of the womb, or it's simply vaginal, or when is it what we call real menstrual blood? And it's a little bit of an introduction to obstetrics in the Gemara in Masachet Nida. It's a fascinating, it's a magnificent Masachet. I have always believed that the best Masachet are the ones about women, because that's what made the men concentrate. The best Masachet are... The best masachot are always about the women. You better believe it. This is when the students pay attention. They pay attention to this. Okay? So, as soon as the way in which it is described, by the way, is one of the ways is Adom Kashoshana. I read like a rose. And here you have the sugah b'shoshanim. Okay, you also have the rose come in. That's a case where it wouldn't be a lily. It would certainly be a rose in that context. But from the time that the woman acknowledges the fact that, according to her observation, that she sees menstrual blood, then she and her husband cannot have any sexual relations. It is forbidden. According to the Torah, it is forbidden for 7 days, and at the end of that 7-day period, she goes to the mikveh, and after that, they can have sexual relations with each other. In rabbinic Judaism, and in Jewish practice till today, that is not the law. The law is that the period of menstruation, even if it's a very short period, is considered to be a minimal 5-day period of time. If it lasts longer, well, this period lasts as long as it lasts. Whenever it ends, you add 7 days. We add 7 days. So basically, it tends to be a 12-day period of time. From the period of the rabbis until today, including today, it's generally a 12-day period. It could be longer. Just depending upon the physical realities. So during that period of time, sexual relations are absolutely forbidden. Absolutely. Now I say absolutely, I mean absolutely. That is one of the prohibitions, which is a prohibition of karet. Karet is one of the most serious prohibitions of the Torah. This appears in the book of Leviticus. It appears twice in the book of Leviticus. And it is first in the portion that we read in Acharei Mot, the end of the portion of Acharei Mot, which we read on the afternoon of Yom Kippur. Okay? And then it appears in the next Aramaic. It also appears in Kedoshim. And it is the latter part of the Parsha of Kedoshim. And there it is all of these, the Erevahs, they're called, the prohibited sexual relations, most of which have to do with inter-family prohibited relations, but there are additional ones, and this is among them, that are prohibited sexual relations from the Torah. So this is really heavy-duty, serious business as far as the halacha is concerned. Now, that having been said, I just explained to you, even as far as the law was developed in rabbinic times, and as it exists today, we have all kinds of fences around the law. We have fences around the law. The law is constructed generally with a variety of fences that are made by the rabbis. The rabbis make the fences in order to protect you from abrogating the law of the Torah. Okay? It's a natural thing that they do. So the heretic comes and says, this is ridiculous. You have all kinds of fences. Okay? But look at the law here of a man and a woman. In fact, the Torah, the rabbis, the Torah is not entirely clear, but the rabbis understood the law to be that a husband and a wife can be alone together. They can be alone together during the time that she is prohibited to him. Okay? Now that's not necessarily obvious. As a matter of fact, generally speaking, it is prohibited for a man and a woman to be together, alone, with no one else there, if that man and woman might be in the position of transgressing the law of the Torah. Okay? I explained last week when we began to talk a little bit about this that we had a teacher in the seminary who always said to us, the first rule of pastoral visits is leave the door open. Leave the door how much open? At least a little bit open. Okay? We know, last week with a case. We had a case in the rabbinical assembly of some rabbi who was brought up on charges internally and was kicked out of the rabbinical organization because of sexual involvement with someone from his congregation. Okay? This today is a big issue. The issue of sexual harassment is one thing. Not in the CIA, right? Not in the CIA and places like that, which are well protected, right? And you would think that, people would have the immediate sense that you just can't do it. In this area, it goes on. Believe me, my friends, you believe it. You see what's going on in the paper today. And every time I tune in on the internet, there's another interesting thing in there. And you know what? I want to tune in again to see what's happening. So, Okay. Wait, I've got to keep going. Okay. No, let me keep going here. Okay? So, the strength is, so it makes sense, it would seem to make sense, to create a series of unbreachable fences. And that is what I can see happens. Also, it happens in the school system. It certainly has happened in my own profession. The profession itself tries to articulate what are the rules and what are the punishments to make sure that some of these things which we consider to be unacceptable behavior simply won't happen. Or we minimize them to the smallest possible degree. So, take the case of the husband and the wife. Husband and the wife. They're used to having a certain level of relationship. Okay? Suddenly the time comes and it's a breach of the law of the Torah if they were to continue that. And yet, in most of the cases where that might happen, we prohibit people to be alone, absolutely alone with each other. That's called yichud, where they are alone together. But in the case of the husband and the wife, we don't. We don't prohibit it. We allow them to be together. Okay? So the min, the heretic, says, this is not a smart religion you have. This is a stupid religion that you have. Because his purpose, naturally, in coming to attack Rav Kahana, is to show him how foolish this religion is. That's what he wants to do. So what can Rav Kahana's answer be? His answer is the fascinating answer here. His answer is, HaTorah he'ida aleinu. The Torah testified about us, about the Jews, suga bashoshanim, that they are fenced by a hedge of roses. She'afilu kusuga bashoshanim, that Israel will not make breaches even through a hedge of roses. In other words, there is a level of self-restraint, of respect for the law, which Jews have, so that we don't really have to go to that extent. Even though it is a serious business, people can and will control themselves because they really respect the system within which they are operating. That's really an extraordinary thing to say. It's really an extraordinary thing to say. Realize that there are very few such permissible situations. As a matter of fact, earlier on in this Masechet, the question is raised and an effort is made to articulate one of them, which is really very... just think about it for a minute. The laws of Erva, the prohibited sexual relations... Many of them have to do with parent and children relations. Parents and children are not allowed to have sexual relations with each other. Obviously, that is a case where parents and children are frequently alone with each other. So there, too, the question comes up whether it is permissible for a father to be with his daughter and a son to be with his mother without anyone else there. Without the other parent being there, for example. And there, that too is an exception to the rule. And in fact, though the general rule about erva is that all such relations that are prohibited by the Torah, yichud is likewise prohibited. You're not allowed to be alone with that person, with the exception of a mother, a sister, or a daughter. Those are exceptions. Mother, sister, and daughter are exceptions. So, the father also, that would be the other side of it. And that is articulated elsewhere in the Masechet in Sanhedrin. Here, we deal with, in a way, the more interesting case, which is the case of the husband and the wife, where there is not only an ongoing sexual attraction, but where we can well understand that they would not want to allow this to get in the way. Now, Let's read together the Tosafot here. The top of the page, on Laman Zayin Amud Aleph, there's a lovely Tosafot. It's lovely and it's also interesting because we have to think a little bit about the psychology here, and you can see certain psychological and ethical issues that are raised by the Tosafot. This is top of the page. Remember who the Tosafot are. Tosafot are the teachers that come in the generation after Rashi. Okay, Tosafot means addenda, extras. They're extra to the Rashi. They are an addition, A-D-D-I-T-I-O-N, to the Rashi. They are the generation and two after Rashi himself. So they're Rashi's children, grandchildren, the rabbis of that time. They're French. They're French rabbis, as Rashi was French. So we can frequently see the way in which an issue was dealt with, and I mentioned that they're French, because I'm glad we have a French speaker with us tonight, and that if there is any culture that emphasizes the, how can I say it, the centrality of sexuality, of sex, I would say it is the French culture. You know the story that they tell about the elephant. There were three people who were asked to write a story about the elephant. There was an Englishman, a Frenchman, and a Jewish man. So each was asked to write a story. The Englishman wrote the story Hunting the Elephant. The Frenchman wrote the story The Sex Life of the Elephant. And the Jewish man wrote the story The Elephant and the Jewish Problem. So I told you that story. So if you don't know that the French are interested in sex, you would be reminded about that. Now, the Tosafot are growing up in Provence. Okay, in Troyes, in Champagne. They're in Champagne, not too far from Paris, though it's northern France, northeastern France. And let's read what they say. They are, Rashi is on the right side of the text, the Tosafot is on the left side of the text. The Tosafot begins, HaTorah he'ida alenu suga b'shosh anim. The Torah testified about us that we can be surrounded, but the law is to us, in fact, like a hedge of roses. Le'inyan dam nidot nidrash. Kesha omeret dam kashoshana aduma ra'iti miyad poresh. Now here, the Tosafot makes the connection between the way in which the rose is used in Masechet Nidah and the fact that it appears in this verse and in this context. It says literally, le'inyan dam nidot, as far as the subject of the blood of menstruation is concerned, nidrash, it is interpreted, kisha omeret, when the woman says, dam kashoshana aduma, this blood is like a red rose, ra'iti, that's the blood that I have looked at, miyad poresh, he knows then that he's not allowed to have relations with her. Okay? The im tomar v'hayichud dioraita hi. If you would want to say that the subject of yichud means that you're not allowed to be together with someone else who is forbidden to you by the Torah, that prohibition is a prohibition of the Torah. Alright? If you would say im yichud dioraita hi kedadarshinan, as we say earlier in this Masechet Daf Kaf Aleph, mi ki yasicha imcha ben imecha, There the discussion had to do with a verse from the Torah where it says, if the son of your mother should incite to idolatry. The discussion there in the Gemara is, if the son of your mother should incite to idolatry, then the Gemara asks, and what about the daughter of your father? Why does it talk about the son of your mother? Because it is simply saying the son and the mother, who of course are prohibited to have relations according to the Torah, and who should not be allowed to be with each other. If the son could incite the mother, that is to say, to idolatry, which is to say, it's quiet. They're alone together. They're alone together, right? So therefore we learn the Torah never had to tell us this except to create an exception to the rule. An exception to the rule that the son, in fact, is allowed to be with the mother. Okay? So that's the way it's interpreted there. But the point is that you need... How can you have it? How can the rabbis create exceptions to a rule of the Torah? Right? The Torah is the Torah. If the Torah forbids something, the rabbis can't permit it. Therefore, according to the Talmud, as the Tosafot understand it, the Torah itself prohibits yichud. They prohibit these people who are forbidden to each other to be alone together. Hechi amar kra de divrei kabbalah. How can we say that divrei kabbalah lenishrei mai dichtiv bioraita, that the words of the rabbis can come and permit that which is prohibited by the Torah? Right? That's implicitly what we're saying here, and that's what we're reading here in the Talmud. How could the rabbis ever say such a thing? Okay. V'yesh lomar. It's a good question that they ask. Okay, so now the Tosafot explains in the following. V'yesh lomar. The lo asra Torah ila ke'en imo. The Torah forbids only, namely in this absolute prohibition, only prohibits those relations which are ke'en imo, like that of a child with the mother. He explains, the lo avida de nishtere, which can in no circumstances ever be permissible. So a child is never permitted to have sexual relations with the mother. And in that case, in the case of where you're never allowed to have sexual relations with a person, all right, in that case, it is prohibited by the Torah to have yichud with that person, with the exception of those few exceptions we said. Okay? But the what we're dealing with here, the case of the nida, is an exception. Why? Because as soon as the 12 days pass, then you can have relations with her. Simply, you can't have relations with that person while she is a nida. Aval nida sofalitaher. But a nida will pass through and become ritually pure. She'll go to the mikveh. She'll go to the mikveh. Let's stop here for a second. So the reasoning of the Tosafot is, in a case where a man knows that he is going to be able to have sex with his wife, that enables him to say to himself, I can control myself. I can have control. It's fascinating. One might have thought of it exactly the opposite. It's exactly in those cases where you could never possibly be allowed to do this that you'd have the most obvious control. But Tosafot is fascinating to me, the psychology, the way they see it, and I think to myself, I'm wondering whether this has anything to do with French culture. They say that it is really those cases where, in fact, you know you will be able to satisfy your desire, where you're able best to control your desire. That's the way they understand it. And that's the reasoning then why the Nida is in a unique position. In the unique position. Okay? Comments?
How do rabbis reconcile this concept of offense with a prohibition of adding and subtracting to the law?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. The Torah says you're not allowed to add or subtract to the law. Yet they are obviously adding to the law. Okay? They understood it to mean that you're not allowed to add to the Torah. Now, you can't say that there are 614 commandments of the Torah. That's what it means not to add. You cannot say there are 612 commandments of the Torah. You cannot say that something that that has always been interpreted as a law of the Torah, that the Torah says, for example, that you're not allowed to light fire on the Sabbath. And we say that, oh well, it's because it was very difficult to light fire in the old days. And really, it's not a law of the Torah. Can't do that. Can't do that. Right? So you can't detract. And you can't add and you can't say something that is adding to the Torah and you say, this is the law of the Torah. But what you can do is build a fence around the Torah. That's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. Okay? So here you see the case of the Nida and the case of the restraint, which is considered to be restraint that we respect and that in fact exists. And people are able to control their desires, and therefore, in certain cases, we don't really have to make the law around the Torah. I don't know whether any of you have done any reading on this subject, but the first book, and it's almost true to this day, the best book written about the laws of family purity, was the first book written in a modern vein. And, as I say, it has seldom been superseded, to tell you the truth. It was written by Rabbi Norman Lamb. Norman Lamb, who was for many, many years the president of New Yeshiva University. Before that, he was the rabbi of the Jewish Center. The rabbi of the Jewish Center on the west side, West 86th Street. Rabbi Jung and Rabbi Lamb were both rabbis of the Jewish Center. We got married in 1968. I used to go to the Jewish Center. We lived on the west side. Excuse me? You grew up there. So was Lamb rabbi when you were still there, or were you?
I was before Lamb.
You were before Lamb. You were doing Jung's time.
We
are young, right. So, Kaplan before that. Norman Lamb wrote a book called, it was a book about the reasoning for Jewish sexual restraint and the laws of sexual ethics, particularly in marriage, the law of the mikveh and the centrality of this to Jewish life and the logic behind it, the logic of restraint within marriage, in marriage itself. You know what he called it? A Hedge of Roses. That's the name of Norman Lamb's book, A Hedge of Roses. And now you see where he got it from. He simply took this Gemara, and that was how he titled the book.
There was a book by the name Red Tent that dealt with the same issue.
Yes? Red Tent?
Red Tent by
Lamb. Oh, it's a novel. I see. This is not a novel. This is theology, philosophy. And it's a wonderful book if any of you are interested.
Can I ask
yes?
A technical question? The rabbi is looking at what is already a practice in daily life, Jewish life,
right,
the way the court sits and so on. And they ask, well, what is the scriptural origin of this? If we say that the Moses on Sinai received both the written and oral tradition, my understanding is this would be part of the oral tradition, something that evolved through. So the origin is actually the same as the written Torah. It was given at the same time on Sinai. Why do they feel they have to find within the Torah Shebichtav a justification for the Torah Shebichtav?
Okay. I'll answer the following. First of all, the question is good because obviously they didn't think that this necessarily was something that was part of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Because you're right. Had it been part of the oral law, then it would have been obvious. It would have been obvious. So, in all likelihood, they didn't think it was part of the oral law. And what they were doing is that they took what they considered to be the law, either the written law or the oral law as they understood it, and they were looking for other sources in the biblical literature that they could attach it to. Now that may indicate a sense of the interconnectedness, the live interconnectedness of all the scripture. Now I'm not trying to say that what they are doing here is totally artificial, because I'm not convinced that it is. It might be. It might be an interesting exercise, an exercise either of memory or of, I'm sure you've heard sometime in your life a sermon where the rabbi quoted something and it wasn't necessarily convincing, but the point of the sermon was a good one. And you forgave the rabbi for pushing it a little too far because the point was worthwhile. Is this like that? Is this like that? Is this an effort to use literature that people were interested in, enjoyed, were fascinated by, and want to push it far, a little bit farther? It's really very hard to say. Very hard to say. But the very strict notion of oral law, which is behind your question, I don't think applies to what we are reading here. The oral law itself is something that encompasses more than the law that was simply said to Moses on Mount Sinai. It encompasses, among other things, the history and tradition of the rabbis. Four times ago, I went through Maimonides' jurisprudence in his introduction to the Mishnah, and the way in which he understands that there is something called Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh, but then there is also development. Okay? So this I would put in the area, not of Torah Shebaal Peh, not really of oral law per se, in its strict sense, but of development, of what we come to call midrash, of creative interpretation. Sometimes so creative and so interesting and so important that it becomes central. As today in any discussion of Nida, this imagery is now central. Okay. Yes? Just one second. Yes.
Oh, in reality, could the rabbis have come to any other conclusion? You could never keep members of a family unit.
I'd like to see what happens in Ramat Beit Shemesh 2 years from now. If you read the news out of Israel and some of the crazy things that go on, and the level of stricture that some people in the community feel is necessary to separate men from women, you just wait. I'm telling you, it hasn't happened yet. I wouldn't be surprised. In the laws of Nida, even the laws of Nida, for example, I had a discussion years ago with one of the great Orthodox rabbis. We were talking about the liberal nature of the laws of Nida. Are there other things that are liberal? I'll tell you some of them. For example, what we just read, the fact that the law permits a woman to make her own observations. So I just went over that, and I took that for granted. Of course it's true. But you don't have to assume that that's true. Yeah, you don't have to assume that that's true at all. I'm not saying anything about Republicans. I try to be non-political. You understand that. But I can well imagine a society where you wouldn't trust what a woman says. You would say, what does a woman know? What does a woman know? It's true in the laws of kashrut, similarly. Laws of kashrut. How do we trust a woman to know that when she has bought the chicken, made the chicken, and served the chicken, that it's still kosher. How do we trust her? First of all, I've got two problems with it. The first problem is that she's one person. Generally speaking, in the law, how many people do you need to witness something?
Two.
Generally speaking, you need two. Okay? There is, in fact, in the laws of Isser and Heter, an exception to that. The ritual law allows for certain exceptions where you can have a single witness. Single witness. And you can even, the question is whether you can be a witness about yourself. When in the legal system could you ever be a witness about yourself? Okay, this is a real problem. It's a real issue. So now I have two problems with the woman's chicken. And then the third problem is the biggest problem of all. She's a woman. Right? She's a woman. How can we assume that she knows what she's doing, that she has studied? Oh, maybe she has, but maybe she hasn't. Okay? So I'm just telling you that from the perspective of fear, of abrogating the law of the Torah, we might really assume, oh, we had this in New York a while ago. I'll give you another example, just to remember this. In the laws of mikveh, a woman goes to the mikveh. Let's say what normally happens is a woman goes into the mikveh, and there is a mikveh lady who looks to see that her hair has gone under the water. So let's say there wasn't a mikveh lady. Okay? She went to a mikveh where there was no mikveh lady, unsupervised mikveh. She goes under the water. Nobody witnessed her. Is it kosher or not? Kosher or not? Is one witness kosher? Or should there be two women looking? We had an issue here on the West Side years ago. West Side never been a problem. I'll tell you where it was an issue. It's an issue in Washington Heights. The mikveh in Washington Heights, which was the mikveh is run by the Breuer community. Any of you know Breuer? Breuer, you know the Breuer. It's Samson Rayfield. Hirsch. The Breuer community is an especially from German Jewish community. And really tough. Really tough. So in the mikveh uptown, there were two witnesses for the woman going under the water. Two? You had to pay more. So one time I remember the mikveh, we had a problem with the mikveh broke down here. So the women had to go up to Washington Heights. Either you go to Washington Heights or the Lower East Side. So Washington Heights seemed more natural. If you were you're living on the West Side, right on the Broadway subway. So if you go on the Broadway subway, go right up to Washington Heights. And the West Side ladies from the Upper West Side were on the warpath. They were so outraged at the Breuer people because they didn't trust them. They had two witnesses up in the Breuer mikveh. Okay? So I'm just giving you these examples to say that we shouldn't take any of this for granted. This stuff can go crazy. Whenever you're dealing with sex, and whenever you're dealing with women, which, and the two are somewhat connected, in a male world, and that's, you're reading a literature that's coming out of there, and a system that's dominated by that world, this could be a real problem. It could be. The amazing thing is that it isn't. And one of the important things about reading Talmud is to see that the Talmud has this notion of Sugava Shoshanim, that in fact we do have a reasonableness. We do allow things, we do respect the judgments of people. And not only that, here, of course, it's a husband and a wife that we're reflecting on. But the reality is, it goes way beyond that. Because remember the context of the original statement, and that was that the Jews are people like that. It's a general statement made about Am Yisrael, about the Jews. So it's an incredible statement to make about the Jews. Okay, let's go on then. Now look the way the Gemara continues. The Gemara says, Reish Lakish Amar Mehacha. Right? This notion that we are learning about, that the people will not make breaches, and that is the law is to them like a hedge of roses, excuse me, can be learned from also another verse there in the Song of Songs. It says, Kefelech harimon rakatech. It's just amazing. Kefelech harimon rakatech. Like a section of pomegranate are your temples. I assume that the imagery there is the redness. The redness, you cut open a pomegranate, it's a red look. And the freshness of the skin. Women's concern about their skin is very old. It's filled with, you have in the Song of Songs, many, many images come out of the color of the skin, the freshness of the skin, the tenderness of the skin. So this is a basic sexual concern of women and, of course, of men. So, but here, Kefela Harimon, like a section of pomegranate, are your temples. And how is this explained? Afilu Rekanim. Rekanim, it says, Rakatech, your temples. The temples, the side of your cheek. Raka is the temple. Now, again, it's not temple with a capital T, it's temples here. The side of the face. Here, it is related to the word rek. Rek, empty. Empty. Afilu rekanim shabach, even the empty ones among you. No, in other words, the empty heads in the Jewish people. Even the people who are empty of mitzvot. Mleim mitzvot karimon. They are filled with mitzvot like a pomegranate. If you remember, on Rosh Hashanah, we have a pomegranate, is one of the fruits we eat on Rosh Hashanah. Why? May our year be filled with mitzvot, just as the seeds are in the pomegranate. Okay? So the pomegranate has a symbolic sense of the mitzvot. So here the verse is interpreted, the verse which is again another erotic verse, is interpreted in a neurotic fashion, which is, even those of you who are empty of mitzvot, are mele'in mitzvot karimon. You are filled with mitzvot like a pomegranate. Rabbi Zera amar mehacha. Rabbi Zera learned this same idea from another source. Bayarach et reach begadav. This is from this week's Parsha. Okay, this week's Parsha is the story of Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau. Okay, remember to the end of the Parsha, what happens? Jacob wants the blessing. So his mother puts skins on him.
I think his mother wants the blessing.
Okay. So they put the skins on him, and what does the father do? He smells it, okay? Vayarached reach begadav. He smelled the fragrance of his clothes. Al tikre begadav ela bogdav. Don't read it as if it says his clothes. Ela bogdav, his renegades. In other words, even those who are rebellious, the rebellious Jews, they have a beautiful fragrance. Even the Jews who are impossible, they too are Jews, and they have the fragrance of the mitzvot. They have the fragrance of the mitzvot. The same idea here, but he takes it from a different verse. Okay? So here you see, it's extraordinary. The open sense here of the Jews and of the fact that the Jews have qualities. Every Jew has qualities. Every Jew does mitzvot. And if we look at certain Jews and we see that they don't do certain mitzvot, it just means they don't do certain mitzvot, they do other mitzvot. And every time you relate to a Jew, you have to relate and think, what are the mitzvot that this Jew is doing? Okay? It's crucial. This section, I think, is just so, in American Jewish life, in Jewish life in general, I would somehow try to make this our logo. Okay? Try to make it a logo. This is the way Jews have to relate to each other. Just go a little bit further. Hanhu bar yoni dahava bishivavute de Rabbi Zera. There were these bar yoni. Bar yoni, it's translated as ruffians. Bar yoni are thieves. Thugs. Ruffians is too nice a word. They're thugs. There were these thugs who lived, Shivavute in Aramaic is Shchuna in Hebrew. Bishchunato shel Rabbi Zera. They lived in the neighborhood of Rabbi Zera. Rahava mekarev laho, ki heched b'niyad ro laho b'tiyufta. Shehu aya mekarev otam, Rabbi Zera would draw them near, ki heched b'niyad ro, kidei sheyachzaru b'tshuva. In order to make balei tshuva of them, in order to encourage them to become more observant, in other words, to leave their terrible, their thuggish ways. So that was interesting that that's the way he would do it. He would befriend them, and by befriending them, he would feel that he could influence them. He could have a positive influence on them. Even though, now, look what happens next. V'ha'u kafte rabbanan. And the rabbis objected to this. If you're making friends of these guys, you gotta kick them out. Ki nachmach sheh de Rabbi Zera. When Rabbi Zera died, Amrei, they, namely the thugs, said, Ad ha'idna hava charich katin shake da hava bayalan rachmei. Until now, here is a name that the Talmud uses for Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera, Ze'ir, you know what Ze'ir means in Aramaic? Katat, small. So he was short. He was a short rabbi. Okay? And so the Talmud tells a story where he was examining an oven. And because he was so short, he ended up singeing his thighs. When he was too close to the oven itself. The ovens in those days were not stoves like we have, but they were down on the ground. So he's often called in the Talmud by this longer name, Charicha Katin Shake. So Hakatan Shnisraf Shokav. Alright. So the short guy whose thighs got burnt. So he called us. But he was, sometimes I think when they referred to him in that way also, in other words, he's a renegade. He was an oddball. This was an oddball. He was the Shlomo Karlbach of his time. That's what he was. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the literature or remember. Some of you are my contemporaries. So you remember when Shlomo was out in the House of Love and Prayer in Berkeley. Any person in his right mind would say, Shlomo, you're out of your mind. You're crazy. What are you doing with these people? And Shlomo would say exactly what you read here. Shlomo would say, oh, there's so many mitzvot that they do. It's so wonderful. I love them. Did you see what so-and-so did?
But he got it from Rabbi Nachman.
Hey, where do you think Rabbi Nachman got it? From Okay. So now we're in, we're with the thugs. These guys who were the thugs. Ade idna havacharicha gatin shake. Until now, the thugs are talking now. Until now, Rabbi Zera, the Havabayel on Rachme, he would pray for us. Right? Hashta man Bayel on Rachme. Now, who's going to care about us? Here, Haru Bayhu, they took this issue to heart, the Avdu Tshuva, and they did Tshuva. All right? They repented.
They repented.
Okay.
And built a roof.
No, they went to a conservative synagogue. What are you talking about? Okay, it's a wonderful story.
Steinsaltz says it's an appellation given, the scorched one with short legs, an appellation given to Rav Zera after he burned his legs while trying to test his spiritual level by sitting in an oven to see whether the fire would have power over him.
An odd guy.
Walking on coal.
An odd guy. Okay. So, the story is really, it's just a wonderful story about the Jews and about the goodness of every Jew and about the importance of being able to see that even the Rekanim, even those who you might think are empty, are really filled with mitzvot like a remote, just like the seeds of a pomegranate. Are they coming? Yes.
Civilized people having a innate restraint in the sense that by convention they agree on a set of rules by which they're going to live with other people. You can get away with anything you want, generally speaking, even in an organized society. And people do. So other rabbis here simply concerning themselves with Jews and Jewish life and Jewish behavior, or are they making a distinction between the behavior of Jews and other people, rather than the society surrounding them?
My guess is that this is no comment on the others, but I'm not really sure. But it's a good question to keep in mind because of the next Mishnah. The next Mishnah is an extraordinary Mishnah. One of the most extraordinary in the entire Talmudic literature. And in fact, it is relevant to what you just said. And so it would be interesting to think about whether there's a juxtaposition of ideas here. Sometimes I think that ideas grow in the oral law, which is what this is. And essentially, this is an oral system. And that they grow, and they grow because of the thought process, and that maybe this was thought about as a comment on the Jews. Perhaps that's problematic. Maybe there's a problem with that. And it's not clear if it's a comment only on the Jews or whether it's a general comment. Surely it's a comment on the Jews, but I don't know if it's a comment on the Gentiles by being a comment on the Jews. I think personally that maybe it's because of where we Jews are, that this is a really important thing for Jews to say. Not because it's a source of their pride, but it's a source of the way we're trying to control the craziness that goes on in the Jewish community. We're subject to certain types of craziness, and we need to control that, and it's hard to control that. And it goes on all the time, and especially goes on these days. These kinds of discussions are helpful for that. So I see it in that context, but I'm not sure they meant it necessarily only in that context. I don't know. Okay? Yes?
The issue of Nida, is there any timetable that shows when these laws started to be in force? Since before Egypt, when they left Egypt, when they moved, when?
As far as?
Because most of the time we were not in Israel, so, I mean,
yeah, Israel had nothing to do. The issue would be the timing. One would assume that this appears in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus is post Mount Sinai. Okay, so just from the narrative of the Torah itself, well, it's post Sinai, but it's post. Sure, you can do it in the desert.
There is no mikveh.
There is. In the desert, you have mikvehs because the mikveh is running water. You can have it. You don't need to have a mikveh filled the way we fill a mikveh. We have a mikveh on the west side.
It's still water or running water?
Well, it can be still, but it has to be. It has to have a running source.
Right.
A running source. So a mikveh, for example, that we have our mikveh on the west side. The way that is done is that on the roof, you have a roof, you have a brownstone, and on the roof, it's a series of conduits. It's a system of collection. And you collect rainwater. And you collect rainwater, it's got to be natural water. Okay? So you collect water from the natural source, a running source, even the rain is a running source. But that's not the only source of mikveh. A lake can be a mikveh. A river is a mikveh. Biggest mikveh in the world is the Pacific Ocean. Okay? So there are other sources of mikveh in the desert. You have oases. So it is in theory possible. The answer to the question, I have absolutely no idea. The reality is, I have no idea.
The practicality, I don't see, until Jerusalem was built, I don't think that they could even look into this issue.
No, I don't think that's true. Certainly, Jerusalem is at a very much later period of time. You might say, till after Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, that once you have the land of Israel settled, you know, that this is characteristic of a settled people. You might say that, but I really don't know. Yes.
I have a comment about this. There was something that I was reading in Likutei Moharan.
Uh-huh.
I hope I'm pronouncing it right.
Likutei Moharan.
And
that's the writings of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov.
And he was talking specifically about that we need to try to find in everybody a light. He was specifically mm-hmm. talking about this in terms of light.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that everybody, even the worst person, will have some mitzvah that they did at some point. And that that's like a light, and that we, as people, have power to make that light grow by focusing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we should just focus on that light, and that's what we need to do, because by focusing on that light, we make that light grow. And it's this idea of positive reinforcement and uh-huh. seeing the best in people.
Yep.
And I think that that must come directly
from this. Right out of this. This is the source of Rabbi Nachman. But the way Rabbi Nachman articulated it is a particularly, well, modern, that is to say, modern in the early 19th century way, is early 19th century, and that is in terms of light, spiritual light. It's a Kabbalistic kind of imagery that he uses, which is just great. It's a wonderful idea. Yes?
A linguistic comment on the Sugaba Shoshanim. It's clear that the intention of the interpretation here is to see it as a boundary or as a hedge, mm-hmm. and it's of course the vav and the yud are interchangeable in Hebrew. But it came to my mind that in maybe more modern Hebrew, later than this. The phrase Sugaba Shanim is understood differently, used differently, almost the opposite is. In a literary writing, I recall reading something like someone's way was not Sugaba Shanim, meaning it wasn't easy. In other words, the road was not strewn with roses and you just have an easy walk in the mm-hmm. park.
I don't know.
Remember mm-hmm. reading it in literary Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. In that context.
That would make a terrific article. Want to write an article? It's a wonderful article on the imagery of Sugama Shoshan.
No, that's
somewhat different.
Okay.
You're saying
Suga
Bashoshanim.
Suga
Bashoshanim.
Not strongly.
It would be wonderful just to follow that. Look in the Eliezer Ben Yehuda's dictionary
mm-hmm.
and see whether he has some sources in yeah. later literature, in poetry. And you could do that today with a computer. You could
yeah.
just do a really thorough search on Sugama Shoshanim, particularly modern Hebrew literature, see the way it's used. That's a terrific article.
It seems to me that it was the original phrase in Shir HaShirim would lend itself to that kind of interpretation. Strewn the belly, strewn with roses, beautiful roses.
Maybe. Let's go on. I actually want to go a little bit further because I want to finish this section. Amar Abaye Shema Minaki Naide Kul Hu Naide. Remember, we said that when one person leaves, that everybody moves. Musical chairs. You've got to move up to the next seat. V'leim alaho ad ha'idna hava yativna b'resha. What if a person says, person sitting in the first seat of the second row, okay? Now what does he do when he moves? He moves to the last seat of the first row, right? So from his perspective, he's been demoted maybe, because he can't see as well. So he might think that you're better off in the first seat of the second row than the last seat of the first row, okay? So that's to say, Ad ha'idna hava yativ nebereisha. I could say, until now I was sitting at the head. I'm sitting the first seat of the second row. Hashta motiv meli bedavne. Now you're putting me at the end of the row. Okay? To which Amar Abaya says the following. The Amri lehachi. They can tell him the following. Be a tail to lions rather than a head to foxes. Great line from the Bible. Okay? You know, it's much better to be a head to a lion than a tail to a fox. I mean, a tail to a lion than a head to a fox. Alright? Because you're part of something, you know, the top of the world, right? So you're back at the top of the world. But, you know, that's how we have to think about it. You know? And people think about it in terms of jobs. You know, you may move up to the next level and you're the low man on the totem pole, but you're on a higher level. You know, some people would rather be the high man on the low totem pole rather than the low man on the high totem pole. It's better to be the tail of a lion than the head of a fox. To be continued with the next Mishnah. No class next week in 2 weeks. No class next week.
For Thanksgiving.
The Thanksgiving Eve, there'll be no class. Oh.